Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. 55 years ago, on my mother's birthday, old Mother Earth was almost murdered by a few of her children. That was the night of the Cuban Missile Crisis when everyone involved thought they had lost control of their head-on confrontation, and all that was left was pushing the doomsday button. Did one side blink? Or did they all put their fingers in their ears and sing Ring Around Rosie, Ashes, Ashes, All Fall Down? That Saturday night of October 27th, 1962, my mother's 50th birthday, was the worst moment of the Cold War, and perhaps of human history, when it threatened, which it threatened to annihilate. It is now said that our planet and species were not as close to obliteration as the participants thought, and a number of other brushes with nuclear oblivion have occurred since. Many, probably publicly unknown, others from well-publicized systems failures. A 13-cent part, which probably cost the Pentagon $1,300, was at fault in one glitch, an interesting comment on the price of civilization. Although U-2 photographs disclosed incontrovertible evidence on October 14, 1962, that Soviet missiles were stationed in Cuba, President John Kennedy waited until October 22nd to publicly disclose their presence. My younger brother William, who had just enlisted in the United States Air Force, was 19 that day. So in my personal reckoning, the Cuban Missile Crisis started on my brother's birthday and ended on my mother's 5 days later, when politicians overruled generals. If that day humanity barely skirted its own suicide, another October day 16 years later might have proved to be the beginning of the end of the nuclear arms race between the USA and USSR. That was the day the world finally got fed up and bitterly resented that nothing came out of the so-called summit meeting of President Reagan and Premier Gorbachev toward dismantling their nuclear arsenals. I start today's program with the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is studied as an example of missile crisis management, although its lessons might be as obsolete 55 years later as the missiles of that period. I am going to read what I wrote, so I should give a little bit of a disclaimer that I don't think this will blow up the world, and I call it Our Hair Trigger World. The Cuban Missile Crisis started when the U.S. discovered that Russian missiles were being emplaced in Cuba because, Soviet sources later revealed, the USSR thought the U.S. was about to invade the island. The U.S. denied any such attempt, but it had sponsored the Bay of Pigs fiasco the previous year and attempted several times to assassinate Fidel Castro, at least once apparently with exploding cigars. The American myth is that the Soviet Union backed down from the brink of extinction and removed its missiles from Cuba. The myth got a twist in the early 1980s when the Reagan administration concluded that it could successfully force a nuclear showdown with the USSR and actually win a nuclear war if the Soviets did not relent. Every self-protective U.S. scholarship, and no doubt its Soviet counterpart, seemed to overlook what might actually have happened, that both the United States and Soviet political leaders cut their 11th-hour deal, the Soviets to withdraw their missiles from Cuba, the U.S. to remove some obsolete missiles from the Soviet border with Turkey, because the military systems of both countries were moving inexorably toward confrontation. 25 years later, the world was considerably more balanced on a hair trigger. It had got meaner as the less thoughtful or more hateful moved into power and imposed solutions to problems with threats and postures of immense violence. Medical teams decayed, medical terms, I beg your pardon, decayed into sordid military use to avoid descriptions of carnage. Surgical became a malapropos term to describe an act of bombs. The world hung on the slim chance that the major antagonists would back away from the brink each time their bickering or maneuvering for power brought them a gasp or two within nuclear standoff. But they no longer held all the toys. The nuclear club by then was no longer exclusively their own. They're usually watered down in self-serving agreements to limit nuclear weapons were a charade of titans who once had all the power and acted as if they still did. Their failure in October 1986 to slash their stockpiles during the so-called summit meeting in Reykjavik, Iceland, was a sham in a long succession of disarmament performances in which not a single missile was removed for all of the posturing and talk of treaties. The actors raised the hopes of humanity with each drama, composing their dialogue from the desires of the world that nuclear war be avoided. The posture of peacemaking almost backfired at Reykjavik. It nearly happened. Arms control proposals that would virtually eliminate the nuclear arsenals of both nations suddenly rushed upon the American president and Soviet premier, Reagan and Gorbachev, in a flood, and they desperately sought some way to collapse the talks without being swept into abolishing nuclear weapons. Fortunately, and surely to their mutual relief, the American president's obsessive vision of space defense, Star Wars, blocked any hope for agreement. The Soviets thought Star Wars was a first strike scheme. And both leaders left the summit, each sadly condemning the intransigence of the other. That time, however, the summiteers underestimated the world's disappointment and anger. They raised hopes too high for any placation by excuses of strategy, impracticality, or mutual accusations of insincerity. The angry response from all over Earth was that its populations were weary of nuclear fear and deceit. In particular, the millions of citizens who were forced to pinch their own lives to pay for their nation's nuclear terrorism. Intense pressure was put upon the superpowers to quit their power games that only increased the tension and probability of nuclear war. A national campaign in the United States was directed against the corporate manufacturers of nuclear weapons, who most likely would have had the president impeached if he had returned from Reykjavik with agreements that would have canceled their contracts. Demonstrations, shareholder resolutions, and product boycotts were conducted against the top 10 weapons producers: General Dynamics, McDonnell Douglas, Rockwell International, Lockheed, General Electric, Boeing, Westinghouse, Eaton, Litton Industries, and United Technologies. More than 3,000 anti-nuclear activists were arrested, and as many each year from 1983, when the nuclear freeze was first initiated. The immense fortunes made by arms makers overwhelms the qualms of some who work for them might have for producing weapons that might render humanity extinct. The American economy is substantially based on military spending, which is the prime cause of its decline. The public money poured into the nuclear arms race in the United States alone during the Cold War was in the hundreds of trillions and continues to be a major contributor to the nation's deficit. Since the end of World War II and the beginning of the Cold War with the Soviet Union, thousands of private American companies have produced nuclear warheads, the systems for transporting, arming, and launching the weapons. The estimated annual cost for systems exclusively armed with nuclear weapons was nearly $50 billion, which more than doubled when the systems were armed with both nuclear and conventional weapons. Many millions more must be added in nuclear weapons research grants to hundreds of American colleges and universities. The military-industrial mafia of interlocking corporations and the Pentagon has created a black hole into which everything disappears, such as the nation's wealth and resources, with neither replaced. Amidst the flaming testosterone of a new world order, the infrastructure of American society has declined, with ever larger numbers of the nation's most useful citizens sinking deeper into unemployment and poverty. And of course, there is the subject of war profiteering, as ancient and onerous as it is unfair, in particular to the very classes of people who suffer most in expended blood and treasure, while their exploiters deny any existence of class structure in the good old USA and demonize critics as fomenters of class warfare. War profiteering works at many levels. Through grossly inflated contracts with the military, enormous tax cuts to vital war industries, which can be just about every corporation, from bombs to EVDs, and through capital gains accrued from enemy spoils. corruption, and complicity are the two juices that make it all possible. Presidents do indeed consolidate and expand their power during wartime, and their impulse is to quell dissent, which is barely tolerated during normal times and harshly repudiated in times of national crisis when it is necessary. The prudence shown by public officials who are disinclined to dissent is, they claim, from opposing the president during wartime. But as in this instance, when the president has falsely cooked up a war, that discretion is close to aiding and abetting the treachery of a criminally despotic president. The United States is a nation obsessed with military power. The paradox is that the more the U.S. projects its power, the more it will be forced to protect it. Domestic political liberties degenerate when power is given to clerics and generals. The public cringes at the pious exhortations for war worship and the demands for wealth and children for the abyss of military supremacy. The greater cost is the ultimate loss of liberties in the holy names of national defense and national security. Government hides its clandestine acts against foreign governments and its own citizens under official secrets classifications that deny access to the citizenry. Operating away from public scrutiny and on behalf of the narrow interests of an elite few, the government cloaks its corruption with pieties of patriotism and the blessings of God. The nuclear arms race with Soviet Russia for nearly half a century worked a double liability. It critically eroded the tottering remnants of constitutional democracy and held its citizens hostage to the fears and oppressive secrecy it invoked, and it drained hundreds of billions of taxpayers' dollars into the private fortunes of munitions makers. The rubric of national defense continues to place them beyond public scrutiny and accountability in the post-Cold War world, and their wealth, provided by an increasingly disenfranchised and impoverished citizenry, gives them tremendous political power, which is generally stolidly conservative and anti-democratic in nature. Up until the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, American policy during the Cold War had been primarily to relentlessly destroy communism everywhere in the world. The last Cold War president, Reagan, a creature of the arms merchants, wished for history to think of him as both a determined foe of the communist enemy and as a peacemaker, a dual image in an Orwellian sense. Rumor had it that his wife attempted to get him nominated for the 1987 Nobel Peace Prize, and he renamed the MX missile Peacemaker. His presidency might be remembered as an all-out arms race designed to bankrupt the Soviet Union or force it into a nuclear war his administration seemed to believe the U.S. could win. His stubborn refusal to scrap Star Wars, which had a resurgence under George W. Bush and most likely continues along with a 20 times greater nuclear expansion championed by Trump, was perceived by the Soviets as an offensive weapon they feared would smother Moscow with missiles. Reagan's administration also refused to stop nuclear testing because nuclear advocates believed a test ban would halt nuclear weapons advances, which was exactly the argument to stop testing. The official U.S. policy at the time was that a nuclear test ban would occur only when nuclear weapons were no longer relied upon for deterrence. The president's men promised a perpetual nuclear arms race that one claimed, quote, neither we nor the Soviets are ever going to finish designing, testing, setting in place, and targeting nuclear weapons until Armageddon. Armageddon is, of course, the place for the last battle at the end of the world, located in the Middle East, which is currently conflicted with a rise of religious nationalism. Almost all of the world's religions prophesize a final battle, a cataclysm that will end human life. We are now present at prophecy. All of our history has led us to the savage frontier of our most primitive fears. We are as much under assault by barbarity as were the civilizations of antiquity, only from within our own. Those who are maddened by their fear of death eschew life and make themselves into death's instruments, fearfully willing to murder all flesh in exchange for the chimera of eternal life for themselves. Priests openly pray for nuclear war and exhort their flocks to bring about the day of redemption. From this grows a general sense of futility to reverse the technology we have created, a response that it is God's will and irreversible. the military casts are as irresponsible. They speak of themselves as protectors of the peace, yet paralyze themselves to any other worldview except the ultimate battle, which is, after all, the shrine of their profession. The general concept seems to be that any other nation's nuclear arms are weapons of mass destruction, while the world obliterating U.S. arsenal is a nuclear deterrent. This doublethink resonates throughout current American foreign policy, which is nothing less than regression to nuclear blackmail. Be damned if you possess or develop nuclear weapons. Be damned if you don't. War and peace are not abstracts. They are as personal as coitus and death. The way to kill evil is certainly not by killing women, men, and children. The world has been one long slaughterhouse. Any cry for more killing goes back to the hyena. Realizing this is the place for the future to intersect with this new millennium, Graham Greene wrote, "There is always one moment when the door opens and lets in the future." We cannot uninvent nuclear weapons. The knowledge of them is with us for as long as the human race defies its own handicaps and dwells in the galaxy. If we are not smart enough to contain our nuclear goblin, our ruined planet will leave little trace that we once briefly and foolishly ruled Earth. This is a dark time, but the eye is beginning to see. The fog of deception and corruption is starting to tatter, and the contours of betrayal are taking shape, despite increasing and frenzied velocity of the fog machine. The sinister figures who have fogged our sight are revealed for the snarling bullies they truly are. As Elmer Davis said, the first and greatest commandment is, don't let them scare you. Lights do go out in history. Some other civilizations or culture or species, some other time or place, might have to revive freedom and liberty if we show ourselves unable to recover from the grievous wounds upon our democracy by the Trump brand. 99 years ago, the war to end wars ended in an armistice that lasted only 21 years, just long enough to grow a generation to supersede its war-dead fathers in an enormous war that encompassed most of the world and finished with the startling advent of the nuclear age. Though it did not last long, the armistice of November 11, 1918, was a hope that humanity's addiction to warfare had become too horrible to bear. Ironically, the same hope accompanied the larger fears of nuclear power, that a balance of terror would make war obsolete. And that was our Hertringer world, which I wrote. And now, seeing as it is close to Halloween, I'd like to read something by Iris Wild, Burning Witches. And we'll start with a poem by Robin Morgan. Repeat the syllables before the lesson perforates the uterus. Anna Rausch burned 1698, 12 years old. Sybil Lutz burned 1628, 11 years old. Irmer Zian Pichler tortured and burned together with her two children, 1679. Agnes Wadster drowned while her small son was forced to watch her trial by water, 1567. Annabelle Stewart burned alive, 14 years old. Veronica Zerich, compelled to dance in the warm ashes of her executed mother, then burned alive herself, 1734, 14 years old. Frau Dummler, boiled to death in hot oil while pregnant, 1630. What have they done? Are you a good witch or a bad witch? Glinda of Oz. Every Halloween we are besieged with images of a bad witch. Old, warty, toothless hags with black pointy hats, black cats, broomsticks, and steaming cauldrons in which they cook children and puppies. They cast terrible spells and foretell doom in the murders of kings. Cackling and bent, they shriek out of every fairy tale. The myth of the bad witch is an excellent example of how our knowledge and understanding of women's history has been distorted. From earliest times, women have been witches, witchcraft, or witchy. The craft of the wise was a pagan religion of Europe for centuries prior to the rise of Christianity and was the folk religion of the peasantry for hundreds of years after Catholicism prevailed among the ruling classes of the West. The old religion of witchcraft was an earth-centered, nature-oriented world that venerated the goddess, the source of life, as well as her lover, consort, the horned god of animal life and of the hunt. The basic orientation of this religion was to the earth, to life, to nature, with no dichotomy between spirit and flesh, no split between Godhead and the world. Sexuality, fertility, and nature were celebrated. The magic of the witches was an imposing catalog of medical skills and sophisticated knowledge of telepathy, auto and hetero suggestion, hypnotism, and mood-controlling drugs. The witches knew the medical nature of herbs and developed the science of organic medicine before there was a medical profession. Paracelsus, the most famous physician of the Middle Ages, claimed that everything he knew, he had learned from the good women. As Christianity spread across Europe, it attempted to convert the witches, a stubborn, seesaw persistence that lasted for centuries and which left evidence of an increasing mixing of the separate beliefs. Christianity prevailed, and the horned, cloven-hoofed pagan god was changed into the image of Satan. In the 13th century, the church began a 300-year persecution of witches that took the lives of an estimated 9 million persons, 80% of whom were women. The torture and murder were extensive. Some villages, after a witch trial, were left with only one living woman. In one province, 400 women were put to death as witches in a single day. Many of those tortured and killed did not practice witchcraft. Any woman suspected to be independent and free-thinking was put on trial. The church enforced the curse of Eve, Genesis chapter 3, by refusing to permit any alleviation of the pain of childbirth. To be a midwife was to risk the stake and fire. An acquaintance with herbs soothing to pain or healing was looked upon as having been acquired through diabolical agency. Here, to be noted, Jews and heretical thinkers were persecuted. Also, the use of the term faggot to describe homosexuals had its origin in the persecution of witches. When a woman was to be burned as a witch, men accused of homosexuality were bound and mixed with the bundles of kindling, faggots, at the feet of the witch, and set on fire, quote, to kindle a flame foul for a witch to burn in, unquote. The chief document that was used to suppress witchcraft, Cramer and Springer's Malleus Maleficarum, commissioned by the Pope in 1486, discusses the evil nature of women at length. According to this document, the main reason for women's frequent alliance with evil is that she is more carnal than a man, as is clear from her many carnal abominations. There was a defect in the formation of the first woman, since she was formed from a bent rib, and since through this defect she is an imperfect animal, she always deceives. To conclude, all witchcraft comes from carnal lust, which is, in women, insatiable. And that's from the Malleus Maleficarum, which also asserts that women are intellectually like children, have weak memories, are liars by nature, and by nature are instruments of Satan. Anyone would be hard put to come up with a document more frenzied in its women-hating or so destructive. The Malleus Maleficarum was in every courtroom and read by every judge. To disregard it, to challenge its authority, was to commit heresy, a capital crime, and so some 9 million women lost their lives. Today, women are reclaiming the word witch, and with it some of their lost culture. The feminist movement, which began a political, economic, and social struggle, is opening to a spiritual dimension. More women are beginning to turn away from the image of God the Father and sexist teachings inherent in the patriarchal church, and are searching for spiritual fulfillment by investigating the female principle of the universe. Many women are becoming more aware of the moon as a female symbol, and how its cycles of waxing and waning coincide with their menstrual cycle and mental states. Women are choosing to celebrate full moons, solstices, and equinoxes like the witches of old, and are finding the divine within themselves and the natural world. Midwives and natural healers are reviving the ancient arts, and while they no longer fear the flames, they have faced persecution from the established medical profession. It is important for women and men to be aware of how the persecution of witches and the annihilation of an ancient religion has affected women's position today. The heritage, the culture, the knowledge of the ancient priestesses, healers, poets, singers, and seers were nearly lost, but the seeds survived the flames that will blossom in a new age into thousands of Flowers. And that was Burning Witches by Iris Wilde, aka Deborah Cooper, who was a waitress in Cannon Beach when she wrote Burning Witches for the North Coast Times Eagle in October 1980. She was also a member of the Clatsop County Women's Crisis Service, and she lives in San Francisco. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and it is also the 38th anniversary of the Clatsop County Women's Crisis Service, now known as the County Women's Resource Center. The most vulnerable victims of violence and murder are women. They are usually assaulted for purposes of rape or revenge. The assumption is that women, all women, are subservient to all men. Men who hate women, who are psychopathic in their contempt for women, make war on women. They batter, rape, and murder women. They use their muscle and social power to dominate women absolutely and crush them when they resist. Women who have fought back have been ostracized, imprisoned, and executed. Perhaps even millions burned to death as witches during medieval times and afterward, as late as in 17th century New England. 19th century suffragists were often attacked and jailed, and although modern feminists have suffered less than their forebears, more verbal abuse and ridicule than physical assault, the problem of violent attacks by men upon women is no less serious than it has ever been, recently tipping back toward predatory darkness. Organizations to protect women from assault and battery have sprung up all over the USA, inspired not by official concern, but by battered women themselves. Lee Ann Jones Kelly was the original director of the Clatsop County Women's Crisis Service in 1979. And I would like to read Violence Against Women by Margaret Frimuth, who was also a director of the Clatsop County Women's Crisis Service. Violence Against Women. The fear of male violence is bred into women's very souls. It is the fear of being harassed, beaten, threatened, and kidnapped, of being raped, of being tortured and treated as less than a being human, and then killed at the hands of male power. The single most common fear of women is being violated by a man she does not know, the stranger rape, the mugger, the burglar. However, women are constantly surrounded in many forms of male violence. It is in our homes and in our relationships. Our stories are in the newspapers and internet. We hear it in popular music. We are shown violence to women and children in advertising and on TV shows and the movies. Still, we fear the stranger more than we recognize the violence that threatens us every day. Women are trained to be conflicted about these fears. We are simultaneously taught to fear men because of their greater physical strength and to rely on men as our benevolent protectors. Most of us learn to minimize our fears. When we discuss the intuitive dangers around us and our terrors of walking alone at night or the subtle threats that come from male peers, we are often categorized as oversensitive or hysterical. When we find ourselves in abusive relationships, we are told we love too much. When we reject the blaming and focus on the acts of male violence as the problem, we are targeted as angry women and men haters. And most importantly, we have been taught to fear the targeting more than the physical dangers, so that when one woman is targeted, other women learn to step away and remain silent. Their silence is seeped in fear. Historically, women who have been models of strength and outspoken and verbal about the abuses around them have been publicly ridiculed and socially chastised. Many women are beaten when they speak out. No less than 9 million women were burned as witches. Male violence and the fear of violent male retaliation has effectively hidden the truth behind the guise of male protection. Individual violence is also systemic violence. Women and children fall prey to both these violences. If I were granted the power to eliminate all the violence done by women to men and children, would there still be violence in the world? Yes, indeed. If I could eliminate all the violence done by men to women and children, would there still be violence in the world? Yes, probably, but this thought calms me more than the previous question. If men were held accountable for all acts of violence, neither individual nor systemic acts would be socially tolerated. I am weary of being assigned the role of caretaker based on my gender. I am exhausted from caring for women and children without substantial financial stability. Perhaps men could hold themselves accountable by passing a restitution tax subject to all men, based on the premise that men are the predominant violators of women and children. Money from this tax could fund women crisis services and child abuse centers. Crazy? Radical? Perhaps. But the thought brings to mind a more peaceable kingdom. Perhaps it is time for outrageous responses to the outrageous acts of violence. And that was by Margaret Frimuth, Violence Against Women. And Dr. Margaret Frimuth is a former director of the Clatsop County Women's Crisis Service and is the director of VOCA, Victory Over Child Abuse Camp. She wrote this in 1989 for the North Coast Times-Eagle, from which it has been excerpted. And this has been Michael McCusker.